This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey everyone, Boomer Esiason here. The NFL draft is behind us and your favorite team is now gearing up for week number one. The free Odyssey app puts you right in the middle of the pro football conversation with the biggest sports radio stations from across the country. The local voices who know your team the best, giving you their unfiltered takes on the current state of your squad. It's always football season right here on the free Odyssey app.
Welcome back, folks. Are you ready to go party? Now's your chance to win a pair of tickets to the first weekend of Jazz Fest. Today's password is Etouffee. That's Etouffee. That's Etouffee. Now go to WWL.com/contest and register to win. It's that easy. Don't miss your chance to win Jazz Fest tickets plus round trip Jazz Fest Express shuttle passes. WWL is giving away a pair every day this week. All you have to do is listen to Tommy, me, Scooter Sports Talk for the Jazz Fest password of the day to see amazing artists like Chris Stapleton, Jean Batiste, The Killers, The Robert Cray Band, Heart, Rebirth Brass Band, and more. Good luck and happy festing from Miller Lite, the official beer of Jazz Fest and WWL. Etouffee is the word of the day. Joining us now is Francois Cattell, owner of West Bank Fishing out of Empire, Louisiana. The commercial Manhattan season opened April the 15th, and he joins us to talk about some of the compromises that they've reached with the Department of Wildlife and Fisheries Commission. Francois, welcome to the show.
Hi, Newell. Thanks for having me on.
So let's talk about it. Obviously, the beginning of the season is April 15th. I think there were some compromises reached as to what areas are going to be allowed to be fished. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so Noel, the buffer zone which we operate in, which was established 2 years ago, was increased from a quarter of a mile to half a mile off the inside-outside shrimp line. So the inside-outside shrimp line runs from coast to coast, from Texas to Mississippi, and we now have to stay half a mile off that buffer zone, off that shrimp line. And there's been a buffer zone created of around 1 mile down by Holly Beach area. And the buffer zones around Grand Isle have been maintained as they were in previous years.
Obviously, there was a lot of push-pull, tug-of-war friction as to that issue and whether or not what the financial impact or economic impact was going to be to your industry. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so, we're not looking to create animosity with anyone, and obviously, there was a challenge, which essentially was a sort of user conflict in certain areas between us and recreational and charter boats. And it's hoped that this buffer zone alleviates that. It obviously comes at a cost to us. Our boats fish where the fish are, the fish that we target in, which is Menhaden. And so the establishment of those buffer zones has taken approximately 10% of the catches away on an annualized basis. And so we're going to do what we can to see how we can alleviate that, obviously. But it is, it will have a financial burden on us. And hopefully it has a desired effect at relieving some of the user conflict issues.
One of those issues is what's referred to as bycatch, right? The catching of other species of fish while fishing for Menhaden. Do I understand this correctly that there's going to be a bycatch study that will be conducted over the course of the 2024 commercial season?
Yes, that's correct. So it's the study is already underway. In order to sort of be scientifically valid, it has to progress during the entire entirety of a season, and our season started on Monday. The scientists are at sea already, and they'll be observing, be on boats observing the entire width of the Gulf fishery on all the boats, and we'll be quantifying the bycatch of the boats. This has been done before a number of times, so this is a new one. It's been funded by the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries, the funds for this were appropriated just over a year ago, and it's been managed independently with independent observers to make sure that the results are as robust as possible.
Francois, what do you say to detractors that look to our neighboring states that have a lot more restrictive zones relative to menhaden fishing than we have here in Louisiana?
Yeah, I think you got to see that Louisiana is not the same as neighboring states for numerous reasons. Number one is the vast majority of the menhaden that occur in the Gulf sit on the coast of Louisiana. They get fed by nutrients that come down primarily from the Mississippi River. And so the huge concentration of menhaden is in the Louisiana coast. That's the first and most noticeable difference, I suppose, than other states. And the second is the topography of the coastline, where other coastlines, Texas, Mississippi, have what I would refer to as a hard stop coastline. They don't have these extended marshes, etc., that we have in Louisiana. And our ruling line sort of runs down these sort of external islands of Louisiana, and there's vast expanses of water inside those, which are unfortunately are ever increasing. And that's where a lot of the fish resides. We can't fish those, haven't been able to fish those for years, and I'm certainly not seeking to fish those. But that's a big difference between us and, say, the Texas coastline, or even, you know, the far west of the Louisiana coastline, is you don't have these extended marshes that the fish go, that both targets fish like menhaden and bycatch that they sort of reside in.
Yeah, I was going to say that the same conditions and that you just articulated hold true for bycatch as well as to why they're there, right?
Correct. And so, I mean, so you do get, a large part of the resource bycatch and menhaden sit inside Barataria Bay, these places that they are naturally protected from us there.
What percentage of the gross that's harvested every year actually comes from Louisiana as opposed to other Gulf states?
I would say probably, I don't have the exact numbers because we only harvest in Louisiana and land in Louisiana. We don't fish other areas. But the other company that does it, I suspect, probably gets around 10% of their harvest from other areas.
So we would be providing the vast majority of the menhaden harvest every year then?
Yes, yeah, certainly the vast majority of the menhaden harvest is made off Louisiana. I suppose one has to put it in context to the size of the resource that exists off Louisiana. The menhaden industry is harvesting around 2% of the biomass, the estimated biomass on an annualized basis. It's an extremely low level of harvest relative to the biomass by any standards, international standards, et cetera, so, yes, the large portion of the resource is harvested off the Louisiana coast, but the vast majority of the biomass sits off the Louisiana coast.
Is there an opportunity for the utilization of technology, an alternative way of catching menhaden? I mean, you know, it, and I don't mean this in a negative connotation, but it's kind of a, you know, a lot of the way that we fish certain species is done in a very indiscriminate way. You know, and I know for a long time we had the TEDs that came about with the turtle extrusion devices, and is there research going on as it relates to maybe a better way to fish this species?
Well, I think that's one of the things I have to correct is the perception that purseining, which is the way that we catch menhaden, is a wasteful or has a high level of bycatch is an incorrect perception. It's actually one of the cleaner ways of catching fish. The total bycatch that we get is somewhere between 1 to 2% of our landings are bycatch species, which relative to other fishing activities is very low. And so we continue to do what we can to reduce our bycatch. We've put voluntary excluders on the boat so that we do essentially the same thing as people do when they do a catch and release program. We try and exclude out some of the bigger fish that then gets returned to the water as quickly as possible. And as with in the recreational things, some of that fish lives, some of it doesn't live. But all of it has been accounted for in the past bycatch studies. And as I say, those numbers indicate that our level of bycatch is very, very low. But we continue to look for ways, and we're not scared of employing capital to try new technology to improve what we're doing. We're not blind to the fact that as an industry, we have to continue to innovate to improve what we're doing. But the perception that we are an indiscriminate high bycatch user, certainly relative to other fisheries that operate here in the Gulf, we are not.
Well, I was ignorant of the fact. I wasn't trying to make an allegation. I was just curious. You know, I think what folks want to see is always a desire to try and improve, whether or not that's a 2% bycatch. It's, you know, from the perspective of the other side, 1% would be, as they say in the Ninth Ward, more better. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, and I think that's just kind of the underlying friction that exists out there, especially in light of daily limits being minimized for sport fishermen. And the justification for same is that they're saying that a number of these species are overfished, you know, so it's kind of like, well, let's look at this from an all industries perspective, whether that be recreational, commercial, or otherwise, as to what we're all willing to contribute as it relates to these species numbers and trying to improve same. Would you agree or disagree?
No, absolutely. You know, we certainly, to use your phrase, we've made a commitment, and we will continue to put capital and effort into being more better. There's always room for technology and improvement. But I do think that what we do needs to be contextualized. When, you know, this industry has been around since before the Second World War. It reached a peak in the mid-80s, and most people don't know this, that Louisiana Cameron was the biggest fishing harbor in the entire North America at that time. At that time, they were landing over a million tons a year of pogies. There were close to 90 boats operating up and down the coast and somewhere around 11 factories up and down the coast. That was in the mid-80s. Now you have around 25 boats operating, less than a third. You've got three factories operating less than a third, and they're catching under half of the amount of fish that was caught in the mid-80s. And so you're having a lot less sets, et cetera. The point that I'm trying to make is, on aggregate, our bycatch footprint, just by the amount of fish we're catching, et cetera, has gone down since the 80s and continues to decline. But we are not, we're not saying, look, we can't be part of a solution here. Certainly, we would look at our technology and everything like that to improve that, to help limit our footprint on bycatch. We, part of the study is we are going to see how effective the current extruding devices and everything that we have put on the boats, which are voluntary, how effective they are and whether or not we can make them more effective. You know, if we can improve the survival rate of, for example, red drum when it is returned to the water, we will do that. But relative, our footprint is quite low of the red drum. The numbers indicate that our footprint of red drum, for example, that is caught is quite low, and certainly speckled trout is extremely low. And you know, we will continue to do what we can to reduce our footprint. So one of the things I've done recently is I've contributed to a red drum restocking program that is just getting off the ground here. I believe it's just been signed off by the new administration's wildlife and fisheries, and congratulations to them for doing so. And so I've given them some seed capital, and I've indicated that I'd be very supportive of continuing to support that, because I think if, you know, we will continue to try and avoid bycatch and minimize our bycatch as much as possible. But there's a point that we can't, and as I say, I'm more than happy to look at some way in which we could, almost like a carbon offset, try and put some of that bycatch that we do catch back in the water and offset it.
Right. Create a, excuse me, a fisheries program for sure. Let me ask you, you talk about the reduction since the 80s and alike in both the size of the fleet and the size of the catch. Why is that? Why are the numbers diminishing?
So it's purely economic. You know, unfortunately, the product we make, which is fish meal and fish oil, while valuable commodities from a supply chain point of view, are just like the oil industry, are governed by international commodity prices. Where fish meal that's produced here has to compete with fish meal that's produced in Peru and fish meal that's produced in the coast of Africa. And so we as an industry are price takers, not price setters. And the economics have gone against the industry. And unfortunately, you've seen a lot of businesses go under, consolidation of the businesses to create economies of scale, and factories close, boats get shut down, and thousands of people have lost their jobs in the state of Louisiana over the last 3 or 4 decades, purely because of economics. The resource itself, and I don't think anyone would dispute this statement, the resource itself is healthier now than it has been in a number of decades and continues to grow. It's the one resource in the Louisiana coastline that continues to show fairly robust health and growth. And certainly is not by any signs that I've seen showing any signs of being overfished or under any sort of strain. So it's purely been economics, and that's why when areas of fishing are taken away from us, that challenges our economics. And you know, based on history, you can only challenge our economics so much before we in turn will fall over.
What about demand for the product itself, the byproduct, the fish meal, the fish oil? Is that still relatively stable, or is that demand diminishing as well?
No, that demand is stable, and to be quite honest, in certain areas is growing. Certainly, you've seen a lot more inclusion of fish meal, et cetera, into pet food and aquaculture feed. But certainly here in the U.S., it mainly goes to feed into the pet food industry, et cetera. And people have realized that omega-3s, which everyone was taking omega-3 capsules, and mm-hmm. it works wonders for the human body, also does great things for pets. And so you've seen the inclusion of fish meal and fish oil into a number of pet food diets, et cetera, et cetera. So demand is fairly strong or has remained static. But it's the economics that gets challenged. You know, Peru, for example, is 10 times the size of a fish meal producer than the Gulf is. And so, you know, when they decide to put product on the market, they can move the price overnight. And that's what we've got to be able to accommodate in our economics.
Right. Francois, thank you so much for joining us. I'm glad that we were able to pull this together because I had promised our listeners that we would get both sides of this issue. I would like to get you back once the bycatch study is published. That's conducted in 2024 for sure, to get your side of what you think the results there reveal as well. Best of luck to you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Newell, thank you for having me. And anytime you want to come learn about our operation, give me a call. I'd love to take you through it. So thanks for the time and thanks to your listeners.
Thank you, sir. Francois Cattell, owner of West Bank Fishing. They operate out of Empire, Louisiana. We will be right back, folks. Stay with us.
Hey everyone, Boomer Esiason here. The NFL Draft is behind us and your favorite team is now gearing up for week number one. The free Odyssey app puts you right in the middle of the pro football conversation with the biggest sports radio stations from across the country. The local voices who know your team the best, giving you their unfiltered takes on the current state of your squad. It's always football season right here on the free Odyssey app.
Folks, we are joined by Tan Trung, WWL multimedia journalist. He just released his latest podcast, obviously, on right there before Jazz Fest starts. He interviews Quint Davis. Jazz Fest has been in existence, I think, over 50 years now. And, I mean, the stories that could be told by this man is just absolutely mind-boggling. Tan, welcome to the
Neil, thanks for having me on. And you're right. I mean, where do I start with stories from Quint?
the whole cycle of his life has been like one golden horseshoe after the next, I guess there is one way. I mean, you talk about the stars aligning in so many different ways, right?
Oh, you're absolutely right with that, Newell. And you know, for all of us, we love Jazz Fest, but I think that maybe being local, we don't have a fine appreciation of it or a better appreciation of what it takes to pull off an event like that and have it come back every year. But, you know, it really starts with Quint Davis and what he's done over the years. And as you mentioned, you know, he really, if you're talking about a charmed life as it comes to and when it pertains to doing what you love and what you've always loved. And that is his life because, as he explained to me, and you'll hear in the podcast, music has always been a part of his life. It's been central since he was a young boy. And he told me a story about when he was a young boy around maybe the age of 12, that he used to go to bed listening to a transistor radio, putting it underneath the pillow at night, listening to the radio. And here he is, fast forward to 2024, and he's the producer and the man behind the music that we all know as Jazz Fest. It's quite incredible. And again, you know, if there's a charmed life, he's living it.
No, absolutely. Interestingly, he says he can't sing and he doesn't play a musical instrument either. He did hesitatingly admit that he does sing in the car every now and again. But it sounded to me like it's so bad, he can't even subject himself to it.
Well, only Quint will know those secrets. But, yes, I think in private, I think he'll enjoy a moment or two when he busts out singing. But, you know, I found it odd because most people would think that somebody who is so entrenched and so connected to the music community, not just here in New Orleans, but throughout the country, would have some type of musical leaning or quote unquote musical talent. But Quint admittedly says, nah, man, I don't have any of that. I don't sing in the shower. I don't do any of that. But, you know, for what he is and what he represents for the city of New Orleans is nothing short of remarkable, because here is a local boy who, and he said, you know, I don't know if I've grown up, because I asked him, I said, you know, what did you want to be when you grew up? And he's like, well, I don't know if I've grown up yet. But, you know, he is somebody who is a local product, who has made something that is really a local product, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, something that's internationally known and really world acclaimed. And again, you know, next week we're going to start that great ceremony of the fairgrounds opening, and that starting over again. And, you know, it's been over 50 years and we're still going strong. And really the core of the podcast focuses on Quint, his story, and what it's meant for him to go through this journey of coming from a New Orleans local boy to now this music producer of one of the largest music festivals in the world.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. I love the fact that you went back to the very beginning, you know, when the first festival took place at what was then called Beauregard Square, which is now Congo mm-hmm. Square, as to how this all started, how small it truly was, and what it was trying to mimic at that point in time, which was something different. And his partnership with George Wein Festival Productions, Inc., and how that migrated into something else, and then it ultimately migrated into a 501c3 organization that we know today. And what blew me away, a couple of things. 73 acts a day at Jazz Fest. I had no idea. I've been looking at that schedule of acts for years now. I guess never took the time to add them up. But I was blown away by that. You?
Oh, absolutely. Every year. And I think I like you, I look at the schedule and the lineups and the cubes, and I don't know where to go sometimes. But I think that's just for that particular day, because when you're going to Jazz Fest, you're just, you know, selfishly and maybe just more, you know, in the vacuum of what you're going to do, you're just looking at it's like, oh, I'm going to go to Congress, to this stage here, to maybe the blues tent, and then to the gospel tent. But you're just looking at the blocks you want to go to or that certain hour, and then you go over to the headline stage. But, you know, you don't really look at the totality of, you know, both weekends, and then maybe now that they've added an extra Thursday, the amount of acts that you have, and that's all day. You're starting around 11 o'clock, going basically right through 7:30. That is a tremendous chunk of time, and those are a lot of acts to put together. And as you mentioned, I mean, it's remarkable from where it started. And, you know, in 1970, when George Wein wanted to produce something like the Newport Jazz Festival, which is really what was the blueprint, but they really wanted to make something that was unique to New Orleans, and it was at the Municipal Auditorium. But the actual Jazz Fest itself was the act and the performances in the auditorium. Outside, they had a few food booths and a couple of stages that people were playing, you know, what we call roots music. And that was right there was sort of the inception of what Jazz Fest would be. You know, the real show, quote unquote, was supposedly inside the auditorium. The stuff that was happening, what Quint said, just out in the yard, was really what developed into Jazz Fest. So, you know, it's sometimes remarkable to see how something as large as Jazz Fest and as prestigious as Jazz Fest really started in the yard, as yeah. Quint described it. And, you know, it never amazes me how those kind of kernels really blossom into something much bigger.
One thing that I found interesting about the interview, he's pretty terse, right? He's kind of short and to the point, because you delving into about the acts, you know, y'all were coming off a conversation of how he got to book the Rolling Stones, which will be playing on my wife's birthday, May 2nd
of this
year, and we will be there. That was one of her birthday requests to see the Stones, so I'm looking forward to that. But you know, about the quality of the bands and this and that, and I won't give it all away because it's very interesting conversation. And he summed it up this way. He goes, it's easier to get acts today, but they're damn more expensive. I mean, it was just, okay.
You're right. Look, and you know, what always fascinates me is the mechanics and sort of the engineering of how things work. And you can certainly apply that to Jazz Fest because, again, for me, I've been living here for many years, and I just see Jazz Fest as something that happens every year. And I don't think I have a good appreciation of what it takes. And I really wanted to get to know from Quint's point of view, like, how do you get these acts such as the Rolling Stones, and, you know, this year you got Chris Stapleton and Queen Latifah, all these people. It's like, do they call you? Do you call them? How does that work? And, you know, and you'll hear in the podcast that you know, that process is sort of a push-pull. There's a lot of agencies that are trying to get their acts on there as well. But, you know, at the end of the day, he said, yeah, it's remarkable and really amazing how expensive these acts are to get to place them on the stage. And I said, well, what are we talking about? Hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars? And he just says, as you noted there very tersely, yes.
All of the above.
All of the above. A lot of money, baby.
Yeah. You know, it was interesting trying to pull out of him some of the most memorable moments. And it was funny when you asked the question, I thought, oh, my God, he could probably write 12 books. You know, about I can think of so many memorable moments, just myself going in the limited time that I've spent at Jazz Fest. He's there every day, all day, for over 50 years. It would be like an encyclopedia of special moments at Jazz Fest.
You know, and you'd have to kind of divide it and sort of peel back the layers of how Quint would view it. Because I think Quint obviously would have some great, you know, backstage moments and memories with, you know, musicians and acts there. But I wanted to get to know what he does and, you know, how he experiences Jazz Fest when it's actually happening. And he says, you know, I often go around on the golf cart and I go to stage and I look at the acts and I think to myself, should they have been at a different time slot? Were they on the right stage? You know, how are they interacting with the crowd? And it's fascinating to me because as fun and as joyous and, you know, it's really a great party at Jazz Fest, you know, it's also Quint's job. And he has to kind of look at it in a very critical sense to see, like, can I improve this and can we improve this product? You know, how can we get better? And that's the business aspect of it. And, you know, I approached it, and I think maybe this is showing my ignorance, but I thought, you know, wow, Quint Davis is a huge music fan, so he's got to just be jamming out and loving the music when it's happening. But, you know, it's also his job. It's also something that is pretty much a legendary product now here in New Orleans, that you have to kind of be the shepherd and you have to maintain that. And so while this is going on, he's actually evaluating and maybe kind of critiquing and how the show is going. And I think that's also a fascinating aspect of looking at what we see as Jazz Fest.
I love what he said. One thing I look at is, can they actually sing?
But it's true.
I loved it.
It's so true.
You know, it's like, can they actually sing? You know, and how's the crowd reacted to them?
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, and going back to the Rolling Stones, Newell, I think if you remember, you know, there's a portion in the podcast that when he says, you know, look, you know, this is a venue that the Stones don't play. It's a daytime event. It's not in a mega stadium. It's not just one show, and it's during the day. And so you don't have all the production tools. You don't have the pyrotechnics. I'll be the first to admit I've never been to a Stone show. I just never could afford it, money nor the time. But you look at a venue like Jazz Fest, and it's really, and going back to your point of, like, can they sing? This is where you really have to show your chops as a performer. You can't lip sync here. There's no lights. It's on a stage. You're under a tent. You know, you could be dealing with the weather elements, and now you really have to captivate the crowd, which, you know, again, if you're a producer of a music festival, you got to get a talent or a band that's really going to really rock the crowd. And, you know, this is where you kind of have to show and put on display your talents.
And the makeup don't work so good at 85 degrees on a Sunday afternoon either.
You know, so. I got to go back and see if we ever had Kiss. Did Kiss ever play Jazz Fest? And did they go in makeup? That's got to be hard.
I don't know. That would be interesting. That would be interesting. Where can folks find the podcast, Tom?
They can search for the Tom Report. Just punch in THANH Report wherever they get their podcasts. That's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and it's also on the free Odyssey app. And you can go onto the WWL Radio website. You'll see the picture of Quint Davis right on the website. Just click on that, and there's a link to the Tom Report right there.
Great job again, folks. If you're curious about what his special moments, they are revealed in this podcast. You want to check it out for sure. Truly enjoyed it as always. Todd Trun, thank you so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Well, you enjoyed that Rolling Stones show. You tell us, and you better post some pictures on that, Newell.
I will be there. Tan Truong, WWL multimedia journalist. We will be right back, folks. Stay with us. I love it when young folk figure out that they're dispensable, right? That they have options. They could just quit. Google fired over two dozen employees, 28 to be exact, for protesting its $1.2 billion contract with Israel. They staged sit-ins. The vice president of global security for Google, Chris Rackhouse, said that they took over office spaces, they defaced our property, physically impeded the work of other Googlers. Their behavior was unacceptable, extremely disruptive, and they made coworkers feel threatened. And, of course, the response by these individuals that were fired was the nanny-nanny boo-boo routine, complaining about the fact that Google finds more value in the $1.2 billion contract that they have with the genocidal Israeli government and military more than its own workers. Yes, you figured it out. You are dispensable. They're not a not-for-profit. They're in the business to make money. It's simple for these folks. If you don't like the company you work for, quit. You don't need to be disrupting their operations, disrupting what they're doing, defacing their property, attacking other employees because of their belief system and the fact that they are. Just leave. Because for every one of you, there's 1,000 that want to go work for Google that would appreciate the opportunity to work there. So just quit. You don't need to stand in the way of others. And if you believe that they are genocide profiteers, which is what you were chanting and everything else, quit. Why are you there? You're obviously not even a 50% player. These people don't have time to manage 50% players. They're looking for 100% players. Hasta la vista. But it's so nice to hear these stories where people are actually holding folks accountable for their actions day in and day out, disrupting their businesses under the false belief that they have a First Amendment right. Do your work, folks. That's about government intrusion, not Google. You don't get to disrupt their business. You don't have a First Amendment right to do so. We'll be right back. Check in with Scoot when we return. Stay with us. Scoot's up next, and he joins us. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
Well, we'll talk about a few things the Louisiana legislature is going to be talking about. They have been nicknamed the Baton Rouge Boneheads on our show. So we'll get into that a little bit. Also, Indiana's Attorney General is criticizing Bank of America for allegedly discriminating against customers because of their political and religious beliefs. Should companies be allowed to reject doing business with some people because of their politics and religion? We'll get into all of that.
Scoot's up next, folks. Stay tuned. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Have a great Thursday evening. We'll see you guys again in the morning.
Hey, everyone. Boomer Esiason here. The NFL Draft is behind us, and your favorite team is now gearing up for week 1. The free Odyssey app puts you right in the middle of the pro football conversation with the biggest sports radio stations from across the country. The local voices who know your team the best, giving you their unfiltered takes on the current state of your squad. It's always football season right here on the free Odyssey app.